Welcome to Jefferson's Transplant Ed. This is a special limited series podcast dedicated to transplant and powered by Jefferson Health. I'm your host, Dr. Corey Cross. Joining us today is Dr. Eugene Storozynski. Dr. Storozynski is one of the advanced cardiac and pulmonary vascular disease specialists at Thomas Jefferson and is a professor of medicine and oncology. He will be discussing with us what diagnoses and conditions lead a patient to receive a heart transplant and what the next steps are for both patients and providers once a transplant has been determined to be the best option. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
So let's start with some basics. What heart conditions do you most commonly see that lead a patient to need a heart transplant?
So there are two main broad categories, I would say. One is the category of what is called a dilated cardiomyopathy, and one that is more of what is called a restrictive cardiomyopathy. And so within the framework of the dilated cardiomyopathy, you have patients that have suffered a heart attack, could be multiple heart attacks, which has resulted in them having significant heart dysfunction, which can lead them to being very, very symptomatic in normal activities of daily living. In addition to the heart attacks within the dilated group, you have patients that, for example, may have also had previous infections or something called myocarditis, which is an inflammation of the heart muscle, and this could be as a result of a previous viral infection. You have patients that can have a genetic condition, which can result in a dilated cardiomyopathy. And you can also, within that group, have patients that, for example, have issues with their heart valves. And as a result of their heart valves not functioning properly, that in of itself can also result in a dilated cardiomyopathy over time. And if we then go into the other broad category of the so-called restrictive cardiomyopathy, that is where the heart size is either normal in size, where the heart muscle has significantly thickened over time, and that can either be due to genetic conditions such as a condition commonly called hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, or it could be due to some infiltrating condition, such as a condition called amyloidosis or sarcoidosis, which are both conditions that we're learning more and more about. Amyloidosis, there is a genetic component to it, but then there is also a infiltration of abnormal proteins within the heart muscle, and it can make the heart muscle thicken over time. And as it thickens, it can stiffen, and thereby causing significant reduction in overall heart function and significant increase in symptoms in patients. So really, in those cases, what happens is that patients are unable to really provide the necessary blood flow that they warrant in order to be able to participate in all their normal activities of daily living. And that would certainly be true for patients that either have a dilated cardiomyopathy or, as I described, a restrictive cardiomyopathy.
Got it. And so some of these conditions have their basis back in, as you said, genetics or early childhood, and people are living with them, whether they know it or not, for quite a while. At what point, I mean, we all probably know someone who's had a heart attack but hasn't had a heart transplant. Would you say that heart transplants are reserved for the symptomatic, or do we sometimes do it because we know that heart's going to give out and we want to sort of not have the other organs take a hit from having a heart that's not functioning properly?
That's a great, great question. What we always try to do is we try to use all of our tools in our toolbox in order to be able to allow patients to live with their hearts for as long as possible. And there are excellent medications that are available in this day and age, and certainly many of the medications have been utilized in patients that have developed a dilated cardiomyopathy, and the classes of medications include things such as beta blockers, a group of medications that are called RAS inhibitors or ARNIs, and examples of those medications are common medications such as lisinopril, which is an ACE inhibitor, or an ARB such as valsartan or candesartan or losartan. And the newest class of medications is the ARNI, which is the sacubitril, valsartan, or Entresto medication. There are also another class of medications called MRA inhibitors, which are mineralocorticoid inhibitors. And lastly, the newest kid on the block is the SGLT2 inhibitor that we've heard about, such as dapagliflozin, empagliflozin. And these are all medications that are meant to try to stop the progression of the development of deleterious effects on the heart. So, for example, if a patient has suffered a heart attack, one of the first things that might occur is that there could be a release of adrenaline in the body. And the point of that adrenaline is for that failing heart to be able to provide as adequate cardiac output or pumping sufficient blood flow to the rest of the body as possible. But we know that over time, having continued high levels of adrenaline in the body are very bad, because that can lead to further scarring within the heart that can lead to further damage. And as the output out of the heart starts to diminish, there are other hormones, for example, that can be circulating that also in the short term might be very beneficial to try to maintain a sufficient blood pressure, but long term we know are very deleterious. And that is why these different classes of medications have been developed over the last 30, 40 years in order to try to attack each of these different points within the potential deleterious pathways, thereby trying to reverse or at least prevent some of the further worsening of development of progressive cardiomyopathy.
That makes sense. I mean, obviously, we want to try to utilize the patient's own heart for as long as possible. And these medications definitely have prolonged that and made it so that patients can sometimes not even ever need a heart transplant, which is, I think, the goal. What are some things that patients should know about receiving a heart transplant that they might not be aware of? Questions like, once they get a new heart, can they do everything that they used to be able to do, like exercise, or are there medications they'll need to take for the rest of their lives? Explain a little bit about life after transplant and making sure you're not getting sick, all sorts of things that patients don't realize. Like, it's not like you just get your old heart back. You actually have to maintain this new heart.
So these are all great, great questions. I think first and foremost, the reason that we pursue heart transplants in the appropriate candidate is to allow them to try to turn back to as normal of a life as possible that they clearly have not been experiencing while they've been living with daily heart failure. In order to be able to revert back to some degree of normalcy after heart transplantation, patients are prescribed lifelong medications that they have to take on a daily basis. And really, the point of those lifelong medications are for their body to continue to accept the donated heart that is beating in their chest. The immune system plays a very important role in helping to fight off infections, also in allowing us to protect us really from the development of cancer, but it also will prevent the survival of a transplanted organ, because that transplanted organ is not self, meaning that it is received as a gift from a potential donor. And as such, there's a genetic makeup to that organ that is different from the recipient that is going to live with that organ for the rest of their lives. And in order for that organ to beat normally, to function normally, patients do have to be on lifelong medications that keep their immune system in check. And these medications broadly are called immunosuppression medications. And there are different types of immunosuppression medication. As you can imagine, initially, right after heart transplantation occurs, the doses of these immunosuppression medications are usually at their highest. And that is really meant in order to try to trick the body of the recipient in order to accept that new heart so that the body does not reject it, and the body does not, by rejecting it, inadvertently kill it. And over time, as the body is accepting of the transplanted organ, we are able to slowly decrease the doses of these immunosuppressive agents and really get them to, within a couple of years after heart transplantation, to get them to the lowest dose and really what I would call the maintenance dose of these medications. And usually that is comprised of two different medications that we try to keep at the lowest doses possible. And so really what we're trying to achieve is a happy medium where we prevent rejection, but at the same time, we prevent patients being at increased risk of developing infections, and whether these are viral infections or bacterial infections or fungal infections. And also, in trying to long-term prevent the development, the potential development of cancer, because as I mentioned earlier, our immune system plays a very important role in really protecting us from the development of cancer. But what happens often when patients do ultimately develop cancer, and this is even independent of a transplanted organ, is that that cancer cell has evaded the immune system. And by doing so, it's been able to grow and proliferate and then, unfortunately, potentially take over, causing problems and such. So, yes, after heart transplantation, patients do need to remain on lifelong immunosuppression, but these are usually at the lowest possible doses so that, as I mentioned, you know, the patient has the lowest risk of having an infection or developing a cancer, but also preventing the development of rejection.
And as much as it might not be fun to take a lifelong medication, it is definitely preferable to being able to receive this gift of a new heart and really a life hopefully less symptomatic and able to do so much more. It seems like a fair trade-off, I would say.
In general, I would say so as well, especially because remember, the one thing to keep in mind is there are very, very strict criteria for when an individual can be listed for heart transplantation and when they are sick enough in order to be eligible to be considered for receiving the gift of life. And by that time, usually patients are so very symptomatic that they're unable to walk across the room before developing limiting shortness of breath, or they keep on retaining fluid because their heart is really unable to support their body's demands. And as you were alluding to early on, that they can start developing evidence of end organ dysfunction, whether it be kidney dysfunction or liver dysfunction, feeling more tired and fatigued, when you go from those feelings to recovering after a heart transplantation, after one of the biggest surgeries that you can ever imagine, I think for patients that have recovered well without complications, where they're able to now do all of the activities that they've had to put on the back burner for years, whether it be participating in sports or being able to play with their grandchildren or children, it's a miracle, to be honest with you. And I think, you know, the price, of course, is taking some lifelong medications. But I think most of the patients that have undergone heart transplantation, if you were to ask them if that price was worth it, I think most of them would absolutely say that that price was worth it compared to how they were feeling when they were really at the end stages of their heart disease prior to transplantation.
I think that, and correct me if I'm wrong, I think that the reason that it is so hard to get a transplant and there are so many criteria that a patient needs to meet before they're even put on the list, never mind moving up and down the list, is because hearts are hard to come by. And I was wondering if you could speak a little bit to that, really our donation process and how long patients have to wait once they're determined to be able to be on that list.
So since about 2019 or so, there's been a relatively new allocation system that has been developed through UNOS, which is the United Organ Sharing Network. And these criteria help try to objectively determine how ill someone is, and based on that severity of illness, will determine the urgency with which they will need and be eligible to undergo a heart transplant. So there are really six categories of urgency, so to speak. You know, the first category is the status one, and these are patients that are typically so sick that they might be on the heart-lung machine. They will oftentimes be on a ventilator. They are so critically ill that if they don't receive a heart transplant within a week or 2 weeks, that they may otherwise will not be able to survive. And then you go from the status one patient to the next category, which is the status two patients. And these are patients that, again, are also very, very ill, fulfill certain criteria where they have to have very low blood pressures. They have to show evidence through invasive monitoring that their heart output is severely reduced, and they are having evidence of significant fluid retention in their lungs, for example, because of the severe weakness of their heart. Then these patients are oftentimes placed on temporary devices that are either implanted by a interventional cardiologist or interventional heart failure specialist or by the surgeons in order to support their ailing heart so that they can then restore blood flow to the organs and support those organs. But these devices are temporary, meaning that you can't just walk out of the hospital with these devices. And being temporary devices, they obviously can't stay in forever. And so here we have patients that maybe are less sick than the first status, but certainly, you know, if they don't receive an organ within the next several weeks to a month or so, they will also perish. The next criteria are patients that maybe are slightly less sick than that, meaning that they're not on a breathing machine. They don't have to have these mechanical temporary devices that are implanted through their blood vessels, but they might be on very high doses of continuous medications to support their heart function and to allow for perfusion within of their organs. And usually these patients are also being continuously monitored through invasive lines or catheters, as they're called, and they have to stay in the hospital for observation. So that typically is a status 3 patient. And the status 4 patient is someone that has fulfilled criteria based on objective testing that they have undergone that shows that they are failing. But these are patients that are still being supported typically on oral medications, maybe some low doses of continuous medications, but they may be able to be at home and waiting for that phone call from their cardiologist or their surgeon to come in because a appropriate heart has been found for them. And then there's the status 5 and the status 6 patients. These are patients that may have been born with congenital heart disease. They may have undergone surgeries when they were babies, or they may have a genetic inherited condition, such as a hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, where they may not fulfill the criteria and also may not be candidates for these other surgical device implantations and such, but they are still stable enough that they're able to be home. They have not been recently hospitalized, but they are certainly manifesting evidence that if they don't get transplanted within, 6 months to a year or so, that they may not survive. And then the status 6 patients are usually not ill enough to warrant either the initiation of some of these continuous medications or hospitalizations for the development of acute decompensated congestive heart failure.
Thank you. Yeah, that I think makes it very, very clear to anyone listening the stages and why some people can say that they've been waiting for a heart for a very long time, whereas other people may not have that same experience. Different diseases manifest and really develop in different ways. Some are faster moving than others. And so different patients have different experiences with the transplant list and how long it takes if they are successful in getting a heart. I was wondering, as we sort of wrap it up, I've been reading in the news that there are a lot of interesting things on the horizon with regards to transplants. I mean, I remember when I was a kid, I was not alive in 1964 when they did the first transplant of a chimpanzee heart into a person. However, I do remember reading about those things. And then recently, last year, I read about, I think it was in maybe Baltimore, they put a genetically modified pig heart into a person. And I think it was a gentleman. And I believe he did quite well. And then I was reading that Stanford is, and I remember this in residency, they were talking about being able to start using scaffolds and putting stem cells on scaffolds to be able to build organs. And so I think Stanford is trying to build a heart one layer at a time. And I think Michigan has been successful in building a mini heart. And so all of that just seems so exciting on the transplant front and would, I guess, make transplant surgeons an awful lot busier. But if you could just comment on sort of what's on the horizon and where we are with that.
Yeah, I mean, I think all the examples that you gave are really, really exciting examples. And the reason that ongoing research is so important is because of how extensive heart failure, the disease process, is not only in America, but really all over the world, right? You have lots of patients that unfortunately develop a heart condition. Many of them develop that through no fault of their own. It's not like they've been smoking or they've been doing drugs and they've been taking their medications, but there may be a genetic component, as I was alluding to, a viral component. They may be at risk for developing arrhythmias and life-threatening arrhythmias, which can then predispose them to the development of heart failure. But given the large number of patients that are at risk for dying from congestive heart failure, and really the shortage overall of available hearts, there needs to be a solution that is made. And certainly one solution could be the genetic modification of organs from other species that may someday be usable. I think even if we do these experiments in a ethically responsible way, we can learn a lot. And it may be that we also learn, maybe through some of those experiments, how we can better treat existing heart disease so that we don't get to the point of needing to proceed with heart transplantation. I think the idea and the notion of stem cell therapy is very interesting and intriguing. I think the hard part that I foresee is that the heart is such an intricate organ. And I say that just like the brain, right? Both organs, the brain is so intricate because you have to be able to somehow understand, process all this information. And there are so many different components within the brain that we're just not aware of that process our emotions, process our ability for computation, process our speaking ability, and all these things. And how can we develop a brain? Well, the same thing is really true for the heart. We have to have specialized cells within the heart that not only have to be able to contract and relax, but they also have to be able to propagate electrical signals from one part to the next part and propagate it in such a way that it doesn't short circuit. Because if it short circuits, well, by golly, that can cause the heart to stop, and suddenly you have an organ that you're expecting to develop to be able to pump out adequate blood flow, and now all of a sudden it's doing it in a chaotic fashion, and that can certainly result in someone having syncope or passing out or arrhythmias, or worse, just dying because of a lack of blood flow to the brain and other organs. So, I mean, I think as exciting as all of these breakthroughs are, I think with the more experimentation that occurs and the more research that occurs, we realize that the heart in particular is just so incredibly intricate, an incredible nut to crack, so to speak, that to be able to really develop an organ from scratch in which all of these components are working in harmony, I think that is something that, if it's going to be a living tissue, is something that may be more difficult. However, I think that one of the advents in the future for those patients that may not be able to wait for heart transplantation are certainly the development and the refinement of surgically implanted mechanical heart pumps. And if these surgically implanted mechanical heart pumps could be fully implantable, where you have a constant source of energy that's able to run the pump, and if there was some mechanism by which if a person is resting, the pump would only work, contract so often, but if a person is starting to exercise, that somehow the pump is able to sense that there is a need for increase in the cardiac output, just like our own bodies are able to accommodate, then that would be something that could potentially overtake heart transplant in the future, where in those cases, those patients may not necessarily need to be on lifelong immunosuppression medicines because most metals are inert and they rarely necessarily cause rejection. But what we need to do is find a way by which we can ensure that the devices will never fail, and we can develop some smart devices that have some kind of an algorithm that allows for the increased in heart output when necessary if a person is trying to, for example, exercise or become active or something like that. Certainly, I think that all of these things are not mutually exclusive, so by no means am I advocating that we only research mechanical solutions to biological solutions, but I think it's going to take a potentially longer time to find a biological solution that'll be able to replace the intricacies of our heart than it may be to find a mechanical solution that is fully implantable, that could be rechargeable, that has a very, very, very low risk of failure. Obviously, it had to have no failure, right? Because otherwise, if a mechanical heart were to fail on a patient, then that could be catastrophic.
That's all very interesting. And you're right. The heart is just such a marvelous organ. You don't really think of that just as a pump, but the electrical circuitry that goes into making it function. You know, when you learn about it in medical school, it's pretty mind-blowing.
Right.
So yeah, it's an amazing organ. And I see your point as to how difficult that would be to really grow. And we've already been able to make a pacemaker, so perhaps something along those lines as a pump might be something that will come out and be able to help people who are further down the list. But this has been an amazing conversation. I really enjoyed listening and learning from you. I want to thank you for taking the time to join us today and sharing your thoughts and expertise with us.
Well, thank you very much. I truly appreciated it as well.
For more information on transplants, visit jeffersonhealth.org/transplant. To refer a patient, please call 215-955-8900, or patients can call 1-800-JEFF-NOW. That's 1-800-JEFF-NOW. That concludes this episode of Jefferson's Transplant Ed Podcast. If you found this podcast helpful, please share it on your social channels, and be sure to check out the entire podcast library for other topics that might interest you.